Okay, let's get started. Does this mic work? Oh, maybe not. Okay. So I tried getting some information about the book and I got nowhere. Advising doesn't know whether you're supposed to get a book or not. They're like, we don't know. I talked to the instructor of the other section and he said he can't find it either. So, and I don't know whether you've paid for it or not. There's no way for me to. So that's, if you haven't, then well, go ahead and get a copy. If you want to, that's completely up to you. Any edition, the current edition is 9th. 8th is fine, 7th is fine, 6th is fine, 5th is fine, or 9th is fine. Up to you. Okay? It's more or less the same textbook. You've probably attended recitation. And so 1 week of recitation is over. There was nothing much to cover, probably, but yeah.
The teacher for our recitation class didn't show up. So on Tuesday.
Tuesday did not show up?
It was right after this class.
Okay. Well, the next one is on a Tuesday. Monday is. Monday is a holiday, I believe. And so, okay, I'll talk to him. Maybe there was some confusion. Well, I don't know if they switched timings. I thought the recitation was on Thursday, but I don't know. But yeah, I noticed it was on Tuesday. And if he didn't show up, that's not good. But happens. I haven't posted any office hours yet. I'll probably start holding it on Wednesday afternoons, but if you need to talk to me, send me email. If anybody finds out anything about the mystery of the book, post it on the discussion board so that others get to know. So we talked a little bit about operating systems last class, but today I want to get a little bit more into it. It won't be too technical yet. All of these words sound very different, but they are pretty much the same thing. It's description of an operating system. It's low-level software in the sense that it uses certain opcodes and certain algorithms that are typically not used in application programs. The reason being as follows. Let's say for every computer that's out there, there's, of course, a disk attached to it. How do you read a sector from the disk? We don't know, we don't care. Is any application program able to read a sector from a disk? No. However, even if they were allowed to do that, then every application programmer would have to write this code to read the sector from the disk. We want to write an application, not figure out how to read from a disk. So take the disk reading code, stick it somewhere else, make it available to applications. And these are various little pieces that are in their operating system such that applications or application programmers do not have to use it or know about it or even misuse it as because disk reading code can mess up with files and things like that if you don't know what you're doing. So it protects the application from each other, it protects the files from each other, it protects the kernel. So that was just an example. So it's low level in the sense that moving the disk head, getting a sector from there, how do you address a disk, how many sectors are there? These are things that are written often in assembly and it exists in the operating system so that higher level code, which is applications, do not have to reinvent the wheel. Okay? It's a resource manager, so disk sectors, which file should be on which sector, which, how do we organize things? Again, so these are resources, the CPU is a resource, the memory is a resource, these things have to be managed so that separate applications can run separately without interfering with each other, using some algorithms, using some strategies and policies that do not have to be known to the application programmer. Sure, there's nothing secretive about it, it can be known, but it is enforced by some other entity, which is the operating system. So it boils down to, so the first two things say that, of course, the operating system is software, it's code, and this code consists of a blob of code sitting somewhere, which consists of libraries, system calls, and interrupt handlers. And these things are slightly different. They are all collections of functions. And then there is a bunch of data also. So the code is here, the data is here, and the code consists of lots and lots of functions, the libraries. The libraries exist both in the operating system as well as there's something called the user libraries, MAT libraries, C standard library. So libraries exist at both places. Again, what's a library? A collection of functions. What's a system called? Another collection of functions. Slightly different functionality. What's an interrupt handler? A collection of functions. So what these functions do is something we will discuss, but all that an operating system is a bunch of static code implementing a variety of functions along with data, global data, that these functions use. That data will contain things like the memory allocation of each process, which process ID is running which file, where are the files stored, what is the layout of the disk, what's coming in from the user typing at the terminal or playing with the mouse or the clicks, all that is recorded in that piece of data which is part of the operating system. And this whole thing is often called the it's called the kernel because, well, it's the kernel, it's the heart of the system which handles mysterious things, supposedly. Okay? So the operating system's kernel is a contiguous piece of memory stored in the RAM of the machine, almost always resident. That means application programs come and go, can be swapped in and out, can have demand paging properties. This one just sits there. This one sits there, is available to all applications, and it implements a certain set of functions. Okay? That's one view of an operating system. But this thing runs on a computer. And what is a computer? A computer, as you are aware of, consists of essentially a CPU and a memory. Yes, there is disks, networking, keyboards, mice, other gaming features, whatever, but the main heart of the computer is the CPU and the memory. Given a CPU and a memory, the CPU has very selective operation procedure that it looks at a program counter. The memory has memory slots, all numbered. The CPU looks at the program counter, pulls an instruction from memory, and executes it, and goes to the next instruction. That's all it does. So for the CPU to do anything, you need to have a program in memory. Right? And to get a program in memory, you would need to get the program from somewhere, because the memory doesn't contain anything when powered on. So that somewhere may be on disk or on someplace else. So you've got to find that. Who's going to find that? You need another program that tells the CPU to communicate to the disk. How does the CPU communicate with the disk? That depends upon the motherboard and the various artifacts of the hardware. So this becomes quite a problem. That how do we even start a computer when there is nothing in memory? And going back to dark ages, we can say how these things evolved. I won't go into that story. It's long. It talks about there was no disks. There was no anything. There used to be some stuff called card readers and paper tape punches and paper tape readers, and then you had to write these little program fragments. So simplifying that story, what happens is that so the memory has nothing. There is something called the ROM, and there is something called BIOS, and here's the CPU. When you power on the system, this ROM appears to be a part of memory. Maybe you're not there, maybe somewhere, no, maybe it's somewhere here. So this is zero. There is no memory there. The ROM gets copied to memory using some hardware logic circuitry. So the ROM gets copied to memory. The BIOS is actually a program that is stored in the ROM. Oh, what is ROM? Read-only memory. So the idea is the read-only memory is burnt in memory. It survives power failures. So that piece of code is always there, sitting in the hardware of the system. When you power on, this gets copied there using some logic circuit, apart from the CPU. The CPU is programmed to always execute at a very fixed location, so the program counter will be pointing somewhere in the BIOS. And that's where you first start executing a boot up sequence. Does that make sense? We don't know anything about the peripherals as yet. So now this boot up sequence consists of a particularly small but well-crafted program called the bootstrap loader. That's where the boot word comes from. Why is it called a bootstrap loader? Anybody know? No? Yeah.
Wasn't it from the early days? This whole process was fairly impossible, so pulling yourself up from your bootstraps.
Yes, and it's still done that way. You pull yourself up so you hold your bootstrap, stand up, you lift yourself. No, that doesn't work, but that's a saying that you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. So this is a loader that is partially in the ROM and partially on disk. Well, nowadays I think they put the whole loader. So what's a loader, I didn't say?
Just
A loader is a program that knows how to read a program, all bits, from somewhere, we have to figure out where, and copy those bits into memory. A bootstrap loader is a loader that loads itself. How does it happen? A part of the loader is in memory already. It reads the next few bytes from the source where today it will be the disk. It reads the next few bytes from disk, puts it into memory. The next few bytes reads more into memory. Then it figures out where it should stop and load the entire loader into memory. So that this loader can now figure out where the files are and what do you have to load next. Okay, so first you get the bootstrap loader. I'm kind of oversimplifying today's computers because they're far more complex than this, but this is the basic starting point. The idea being that the CPU does not do anything with anything unless the program is in memory. So the point is, how do you get programs into memory? You use a loader. But where was the program created? How do we even get the program and store it where it should be for the loader to get? It's a huge chicken and egg problem. So, going one step further, the first part of the boot program is programmed to be able to find a particular sector on the disk, and it knows how to issue those commands or opcodes to get bytes from over here and load it to the next part of the bootstrap loader. Now we've got the whole loader there. Now the loader has enough code in there that it can talk to, let's say, a human over some sort of interface. Earlier it used to be terminals or typewriters and things like that. Now it can be a GUI display, but that comes a lot later. You need a huge amount of software to be loaded before you can talk to a human on that display. So here we are saying we are using a primitive operating system, or we are designing a primitive operating system where a loader loads up, and it's sort of a command interpreter which will ask the user, what do you want to do? So the user, who is really, in this case of the older computers, were a computer operator, user tells the loader a command. And this command could be very simply put, load a compiler or run an application. So let's go with, firstly, in order to run any application, you have to compile it. We're not talking prepackaged stuff here. So the first thing the operator would do is to load a compiler. So the loader would load a compiler. And as the compiler runs, it reads source code. I'm going to skip where it finds the source code. And generates object code. And then, once it finishes running, the operator says, run the object code. So now the object code is binary. The compiler quits and goes back to the loader. The loader asks the operator, what should I do? It says, run the compiler, run the object code. All the bits of the object code are written on top of the area where the compiler was, and now that it's a program, it can run. So this is the very basic operation of a computer, which only has a loader kind of a thing in there. But this is not very useful. So, segueing a bit, the evolution of operating systems started here. That this is a computer, this is how it works, it's terribly inefficient, a human being has to constantly tell it what to do, it takes a long time for all these peripherals to load things, we need to make this far more efficient. And the development of operating systems started with a maxim which is very, very outdated, but which essentially says that computers are very expensive things. They cost millions of dollars. Humans are not that expensive. So we need to, but they are to an extent, but humans make mistakes, take time, go on coffee breaks. So we have to make sure that the computer runs at the highest possible efficiency, does not waste time, does not do things, just waits around for a human. It has to be very efficient at running applications, and it has to know a priori what it should do. It also has to have things like its input-output needs to be faster, its execution needs to be faster, we do not want any idle times in there, etc., etc. Okay, why am I saying this? None of these are true anymore. Computers run around idle all the time. They are, compared to a human being's salary, it's very, very cheap. So none of these should have any influence on modern operating systems. Actually, turned out it's quite the opposite. All these maxims that were developed with the goal of treating the computer as an expensive resource and humans as the cheap resource is completely applicable today. All those mechanisms and algorithms that were developed are part of every modern operating system. Even though the expense ratios have changed, we do want computers to be efficient and fast, and all the old techniques are alive and well. Okay? So whenever I say, okay, this was because the CPU is a very expensive thing, it still applies. It is an expensive thing because you have one or five of them and you want to make the most efficient use of it. So how do we make this thing a little better? Next step up was we expand this loader and call it a resident monitor. A resident monitor is a much more elaborate program that has more functionality than a simple loader. The resident monitor has a whole language by which it can communicate to a user. It can have commands of much richer syntax. Maybe it has a shell, which is a command interpreter, which is a text-based command interface which can run scripts and things like that. And it also has a loader, and it also has an extensive I/O library and a file system where you can store lots of data and programs and things on a disk and give it names. Okay? So now what happens is that somebody can enter a command at the input terminal, and this thing figures out how to pull that application and run it. But the piece of memory used by the application is here. So when you run an application, it will run there. The upper part always remains there. It's never replaced. It runs for as long as the computer runs till it crashes. And you will run one application at a time, and you can batch the applications by pre-typing a whole bunch of commands to say this, then this, then this, or maybe even a more complex syntax that if this works, then do this, if it doesn't, then do that. So if then else's, while loops and all that were part of the shell, and you could script up the whole thing and run the machine, which runs programs one by one in a semi-automated way. And that makes the computer a little smarter and more efficient and not dependent on a human constantly working on it. So this is the starting point of an operating system. Does that look like a kernel? Yes, it does. But is that an operating system? No, it's missing a huge number of features that we expect operating systems to have. Yes. Okay, it is enough code in there that it can actually read a text string typed by a human, let's say, that is a command. And then it can interpret it and do it. Just like if you used a command window on DOS or a shell on Linux, that's a command interpreter. So that sort of a command interpreter was built into the resident monitor, along with the I/O library, along with the loading functions of the. And the command interpreter then gets programmed to do very complex commands that involve if then else's and while loops, so there's a programming language for that. It has its own interpreter, it has its own command processor, so it's a much more functional thing than a simple loader with one or two commands. But on the downside, it is just one program that sits there. It loads one program, be it a compiler or an application or whatever, it loads an object code, runs it, it figures out when it terminates, it can catch some of the errors it throws, and it knows how to terminate it, it knows how to give it a time limit on how long it will run and things like that. However, even here, we can see certain problems. What if this application messes with the resident monitor? What does that mean, messes with it? An application is pure object code, right? So it has add, subtract, move, copy, delete, whatever, the opcodes in there. Can an application writer, writing in assembly, use the store command to write to memory locations that belong to the resident monitor, and let's say write zeros in the resident monitor? What's going to happen? The application will run, but the resident monitor will crash at some point. Now, this is a malicious attack. What if it's not malicious? What if somebody wrote just a bad program which starts writing junk or zeros on the resident monitor?
The app itself requests.
Pardon?
The app itself requests.
App requests?
The app will crash.
The app will crash, when the whole thing will crash, and the resident monitor won't work, and the machine will go dead. Okay? So we don't want the app to stop the running of the machine. We want an efficiently running system. If the app is written poorly, the app should crash and we should be able to load a different app. Okay? We want the control that these things shouldn't control the machine. That thing should. But there is no smart machine. There is just a CPU which just fetch and execute. That's the case today also. Interrupt handlers, protection, memory protection, CPU rings, all that stuff. So that part is needed. Also needed is so this thing. So I won't get into how do we do protection, But we can see that there's a need for protection in even in this simple architecture where you have a little executive program loading other things and running the machine. So we are automating the computer. The working of the computer is being automated by using the computer. It's kind of self-management. And in self-management, since the computer has the power to manage itself, this is also part of the computer. It can unmanage itself. So we need to make sure that these two things don't have equal power. But they both run on the same CPU. So it has the power of the CPU. How do we say that this is lower class than that? Okay, we'll get to that a little bit later. So if I look at time and look at the operation of the machine, I see that the CPU used to run an app. This is useful work. Then this app quits. Let's say it worked fine. Then the command interpreter takes over, the resident monitor takes over, and starts loading the next app. Loading from where? Loading from disk. How long does it take to load from disk? I don't know. But whatever it is, it's much, much slower than executing on a computer. A computer might have executing between 1 million instructions per second back then, 1 billion instructions per second today. But a disk read might take milliseconds, so less than 1,000 disk reads per second. So there's a huge discrepancy in the speed of the CPU and the speed of the disk. So this takes up quite a bit of time, and what's the CPU doing then? Nothing. No useful work is being done. Then it does useful work, then it idles once again. So the idea was we cannot afford to keep a CPU idle. It's very expensive. Not today, it's not expensive, but still we don't want the CPU idle. We want the app 2 to run as fast as possible. This is one problem. And the second IO problem, this one assumes that while the application 1 is running, it just runs on the CPU doing computations only. It doesn't need any input data. It doesn't produce any output data. Is there any such application? That does not need input data, nor does it produce output data. What would it be doing? Is there any application that does not need input data but produces output data?
Background applications.
Background applications, what do they do? That's part of the operating system. An application is something that does useful work. And manage the computer means that it's probably shuffling data around.
Managing the memory, power.
That's part of the operating system. We're talking about work being done. That's what the applications I'm talking about. Is there anything useful that does not read or write data as a standalone application? Clock is a hardware counter. It doesn't use the CPU. And plus, you could say it reads the previous time and computes the next time by adding one to it. Is there an application that only produces output data? No, because it'll only produce the same thing over and over again. So once you run it, it's done. In fact, You don't even need to run it. Every application, think of it, every application reads data and produces data. Be it a music player, video player, web browser, text editor, word processor, number cruncher, simulation app, whatever it is. It takes in data and produces data. Now, how much data does it read, how much data does it write, depends upon the application. So, this thing is kind of wrong. What really happens is that app 1 will run for some time and then spend some time This is what the early operating systems people noticed and didn't like. That applications are, while running, it's idling because it needs to write something out or read something in, and it's reading from disk, or even it could be waiting for user input to type something, which is much larger wait times. And then when it terminates, we have to load the next app, etc. And this is all waste. If we know that we've got to run app 1 followed by app 2, we're not running multiple things, we haven't gotten that smart yet. So we want to run app 1 and app 2 and app 3. This is the behavior that will happen. We're running them sequentially, and we have a lot of waste here. How can we decrease the waste? So two techniques that were invented way back in the 60s, which is very heavily used in every operating system today, are buffering and spooling. Buffering was invented to decrease the amount of time an application spends waiting for input-output while it's executing. Okay? So even if you're running, let's go with we run only one application at a time. So the application starts running, and here we have an I/O wait. Now let's say output. Output is easier to understand. So it does output to disk at that point. What the resident monitors added was an ability for the application to say, I want to output this part of memory. What is output? Output is first assembled in memory and then pushed out on disk. How do you write to disk in a C program or C++ or Java or whatever? You take a variable, you gather output in there, a string, and then you use a printf or a cout or whatever to say this material needs to go out. So when you use a printf or cout, the operating system is informed that there is some data in memory that needs to be shifted to disk and it's going to take some time. The operating system goes, okay, I'm not going to write it out to disk. That takes too much time. What I'm going to do is the data, instead of being written to disk, we write it to some part of free memory. So that means we need to have more memory. Yeah, we are going to pay the price. If you want speed, you've got to pay the price of having extra memory around. So we find some free memory. The data that should have gone on disk, it goes to the free memory called the buffer. But I can't keep doing that. The buffer will fill up. There's only so much. So the net result is that this write to memory happens much quicker. So the next phase starts here. And this thing moves there. This is the next execution. While this execution is happening, I couldn't draw it that well, but the application, instead of writing to disk through the operating system or resident monitor, told the resident monitor, I need to write this to disk. The resident monitor copied it to a buffer or in memory. So it got done much faster. Memory is significantly faster than disk. Then the application started running on the CPU, doing all kinds of calculations. While it's doing the calculations on the CPU, through interrupts, the resident monitor is instructing the disk to copy out of memory using DMA. So that memory buffer is getting emptied onto the disk while the application is running. So what are we getting? Overlapping of the output with the execution of the application. Now, if we were lucky, by the time the execution finished, the buffer would have been cleared. And then it can again do a quick output and start executing again. Okay? Does that make sense? Will it? Can you kind of visually see how this application will run faster now? There's a single application. It does a lot of input-output, but this input-output gets overlapped with its execution, and buffering speeds up the system. I said something about spooling. So while application 1 is running, any output destined towards a printer first goes to buffer so that it runs faster. And while the application is running, the buffer is being cleared to a temporary file, although the application doesn't want it to go to a file. This is a hidden file somewhere. And then the application ends without printing anything. Next application starts up. While this application is running, this spool file is being fed to the printer. It's just a serial line with data going out. That's called spooling. So you spool up the output, you print it later. The printing, the amount of time taken by printing does not affect the running of the applications. We are still in the single application per time mode. Okay? So you see that making this resident monitor more complex, provide more functions, be able to do things like buffering and spooling, makes a difference to the execution efficiency of the whole system, including its disks and the printers. And so the printer is constantly busy because it's printing out old tasks. The disks are reasonably busy because they're emptying buffers or preloading buffers for input, which I didn't talk about. And the programs run faster because they don't directly write to disk, they write to memory. If the memory gets full, the programs get slow because they have to clear that memory into disk. We cannot lose any data, so the program stalled to make sure the buffers are cleared. Then the program is resumed. And all this gameplay is being done by a piece of software that we are calling the resident monitor. The program doesn't know anything about this. It just hands over data to the resident monitor library saying, print this, or put this in a file. And that function does the rest. OK, so now we've got a slightly more complex resident monitor. We still don't have an operating system, but we have the starting point. We have two applications to run. Application one, only when it finishes, we'll start application two. That's not a rule, but that's how the resident monitors work. You can only run one thing at a time, not multiple things. So if we do that, application one will run. We have buffering, so it runs a little faster, and spooling. But then when it terminates, we have to load application two. So there will be time wasted between the two applications. Okay. Second thing we notice is that sometimes different applications have different I/O patterns. App 1 might be producing lots of output. What will happen if App 1 runs first, it produces lots of output? What happens? It will not be able to take advantage of buffering. The buffers will become full, and then the App 1 will run slowly, as if there was no buffer. So every time something goes out, the app one is able to put it in the buffer. Okay, so the app one will run slow. Then finally it finishes, we start app two. App two doesn't produce any output, produces a little. That little gets buffered, so app two finishes fast. But while app two is finishing fast, the disk is not doing anything because there's nothing to do. Now you get the picture. Why can't I mix the two in such a way that I don't have the load time, because while app one is running, I'm loading app two, and mix app one and app two in such a way that app one's buffering time and app is overlapped with app 2's running time. That way we never keep the CPU idle. Can we mix these two so that instead of running them one by one, we'll get a major benefit if I can run them together? How do we run them together? That's a different story, but we have to get a whole bunch of smarts there where at time t, I load app 1. I'm ignoring the load time of app 1. As app 1 is running, app 2 is being loaded. And app 2 is ready here. Then when app 1 does an I.O., app 1 does an I.O. to memory buffer, then it does a buffer, then it does a IO wait because the buffer is full. App 2 can be kept idle, and here when App 1 is doing an IO wait, App 2 runs. And when App 2 does some sort of a IO thing, we switch back to, not quite accurate here, but I'm not trying to be accurate. Anytime App 1 cannot execute because its buffers are full, we run App 2. And once App 2 starts running, it keeps running until its buffers are full, and if it doesn't, then it terminates, then we go back to App 1 and we start App 3. We have a list of applications we have to run. We also decide that we'll run two at a time or three at a time. I've got 20 apps to run. I pick how many I want to run at a time, run them, and do a dance of moving their execution and I/O in such a manner that the CPU is always busy. The disks are more or less busy because we are overlapping so many things and spooling, etc. And I get a lot more done in the same amount of time. And this intermingling two apps is called multitasking. And it overlaps CPU and I/O of multiple processes. Yeah.
So when is memory in the buffer being freed up?
Difficult question. Applications are dumping stuff. Okay, let me try and draw a diagram. Let's say we use a static memory allocation scheme. There's a resident monitor. We can only run two apps. We pre-decide any app running here will get so much memory. Any app running here will get so much memory. They're more or less the same. It's equal. And we have special memory reserved for buffer. Whenever an application tries to write to disk, I write to buffer. Right? But this will get full. But as things are being written here and the app is running, there's a method using interrupts by which we start clearing this into disk at the same time. So the idea is that the more you write, the steady trickle out will keep this empty. But that's wishful thinking. Maybe it'll get full. If it gets full, we tell the app, look, let's clear buffers first, we'll run you later. Let's run this guy. And if this guy starts dumping too much, I'm sorry, we cannot handle everything, but hopefully this guy won't dump too much, and then it can run while my buffers are getting cleared, and once it's a little more clearer, I'll start that one. So I have to have an algorithm which figures out how much space I have in the buffer, who's writing how much, which one should I run at any time. So these are decisions which are called scheduling decisions. That's a little bit of an involved topic that we're not getting into right now. But we can see that by having some sort of a scheduling idea which we can think through as humans, we can run maybe three or four apps with different characteristics and keep them all a little happy. And at the end of the day, five apps will run in the time that would have taken me to run two or three apps if I ran them sequentially without buffering. So I've achieved something out of nothing, not really true. The price I'm paying is more memory. So now we have an operating system, because this thing knows how to handle I/O, knows how to switch between applications, knows how to load applications, figures out how many I can load, and of course I don't want fixed size slots, I want application size slots, and applications come in various sizes and shapes. So this resident monitor goes and looks at each application. How much do you need? We'll stick you in here. Maybe I can put more applications. I'll fit the memory. I'll use it efficiently. That's jump, running multitasking with memory management and all that would qualify you to be an operating system. So the operating system is something that at least has multitasking, protection. Now, protection becomes very important. What if this app is poorly written and scribbles all over this app? This app's programmer will go, why is my app misbehaving? It doesn't misbehave when I ran it yesterday, now it is, and you can't debug it because it's not your fault, it's somebody else scribbling on. So how do we keep the apps separate? The resident monitor shouldn't get corrupted either, and various other things. So all that put together will make an operating system. And is our current operating systems any much different? No. Much more fancier features, but this basically is in there. It was driven by computers being too expensive. And the same thing is done today, even though computers are not expensive. I'll take questions and I'll then talk about protection. Yeah?
What does spooling happen?
Spooling happens only when you're doing output to a slow device like a printer. So it's like buffering, but it adds more stages. Buffering is you put it into memory and you flush it to disk. Spooling is you first put it into memory, then you flush it to disk, then you flush it to the printer. Yeah.
You said there was a scheduler for buffering, but I wasn't sure. Can you read and write to a buffer at the exact same time, or does it have any?
To read and write to a buffer, somebody has to be doing that. And that somebody is the application or the resident monitor running on its behalf. So it is a single thread. We are assuming single CPU systems. So there's only one thing happening at each time. Okay? So even then you can go back and say, how is the buffers getting cleared while the application is running? That is not possible. Interrupts save the day there. As the application is running, there's a timer interrupt going, which starts the next output operation on the disk, and there's a lot of hardware involved to do it in the background without help from the CPU, because the CPU only does one thing at a time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So would there be a point where the buffer is so full that all the application stops and just keep debugging? But then as it's debugging, do the applications just start?
You just start one a little bit and it fills it up again, then you stop everything.
So
yes.
If you're trying to boot up an operating system, it's going really... really slow.
It's not booting process, it's when it's running a lot of applications. Now you won't see that today because we don't, unless if you're running a major bank's batch operation, on your computer there's hardly any applications taking up much I/O space other than it's slow because the network is slow or there is not enough swap space. That topic we haven't covered. So this is still quite a bit removed from what we use today, but the basic primitives are all in here. That there is scheduling going on. Scheduling is which application should run at when, and who's filling up buffers, and how much time should we devote to buffer emptying over running applications. Those are decisions that the resident monitor makes. Yeah. No, it's not. It does use the CPU. But I'm kind of assuming the resident monitor doesn't use the CPU because it makes little decisions and it's probably a lot faster than the computation that goes on in the application. Now, interesting thing there is the resident monitor in this example can be termed an operating system. The operating system, doesn't matter today or yesterday, does use CPU. We never consider that the operating system uses CPU. It is supposed to use low amounts of CPU. However, whatever CPU the operating system uses, it's used, I could say that's completely wasted time. It doesn't contribute to my work. My work is, I'm running a simulation program on a machine where somebody else is running something, you know, data centers, etc. That is useful work. The operating system clearing buffers is not useful work. So its operating system is 100% overhead. So I want the overhead to be as low as possible. So why don't we get rid of the operating system? We'll have zero overhead. People have tried that. It doesn't end well. That means you have to recreate all the functions of the operating system. You can run one application a lot faster without an operating system than with, but it just doesn't scale very well. There is too many things going on a computer hardware that an application programmer doesn't want to deal with. So the operating system is kind of a necessary evil. It handles the scheduling, it handles the buffering, it handles the protection, and applications don't have to deal with that, but you're going to pay the price of operating system overhead. Any more? Okay. Now that we have progressed to having, I'll start calling this the operating system. I'll move the buffer to operating system memory and make the operating system larger. We have this sort of a thing in memory. All memory is addressable. And CPU without much loss of generality, we can say all that the CPU does is load the value of an address into some register, do some arithmetic, push the value out to some other address. That's all that the CPU does. So this thing is the same stuff that's going on, whether it's here, here, or over there. And these things are addresses. And addresses can be anywhere. So how do I make sure that if this piece of code came from this application number 2, it does not do a store to the operating system, to application 1, to application 3. It does not do a load from an address which is in somewhere else. Both are bad. Loading means you're looking at the contents of some other application. You really shouldn't be doing that. It's a privacy issue. No, it's worse. You are actually looking at a wrong value, not what you think you're looking at, and you will end up using bad addresses later. We want to stop you from, this is an error, we want to stop you now. And if you store into an address that doesn't belong to you, that's going to cause somebody else harm. Both of these are not acceptable. Now, how are we going to check that those, so this is being run by, let's say this is code from app 2. All these addresses must be within this range. how can I check that all addresses generated by code running from app 2 are within that range, which is, let's call it address X to address Y. Greater than equal to X, less than Y. Who's going to do the checking? How can we do the checking? Operating system does the checking. If the operating system does the checking, then before I do this instruction, I have to do another instruction, which is in the operating system somewhere, which does some checking. How can we do that? We're running straight opcodes. Remember the assembly language programs, they just run. There is nobody adding code to this. Yes, we could have a compiler add checks everywhere here. This code will run 10 times slower, if not 100 times slower. Nobody cares to do that, especially if you take the stance that CPUs are very expensive, then you don't want to slow down your program. And today CPUs are not very expensive, but tell somebody your code will run 10 times slower on my machine than on another's machine, you're not going to sell anything. So code has to run fast. We have no time to check every address used by the CPU when running a program. And the CPU can generate any address and read and write from anywhere in memory. So we've got a problem. Okay? There's only one way to solve this. Put some hardware. Okay. So how do we solve it using hardware? We actually fabricate hardware to sit between the CPU and the memory. This hardware sits on the bus that transmits addresses from the CPU to the memory. Since it's hardware, it can look at very quickly for each address that passes through the bus at the bus speed. That is, without slowing down anything. There is no software doing opcodes, fetch, read, execute here. Whenever an address shows up, it either passes it through or it blocks it. It'll block it if the address is smaller than the base register. The value of the base register is X. And the value of the size register is S. If it's smaller than X, this thing will complain. I'll get to what's the complaint, and it'll block that access. If it's larger than X plus S, then it'll also complain. Okay? So that means as long as you're within X and Y, you run full speed. Nobody bothers you. But this guy will create a problem if you're out of bounds. It generates some sort of a memory error, out of bounds, interrupt. I didn't write it correctly. Now, we have not talked about interrupts yet, but jumping ahead, That interrupt will cause the CPU to jump to a special error handling routine in the resident monitor operating system, which will terminate the application. And in modern Linux systems, you see the message segment. What is a segment fault? A segmentation error, something. Segmentation what? Something to do with segments. And that segmentation fault is really a misnomer. There is no such thing as segments anymore. It used to be there. There was a concept called segments. It's not there anymore, but the term has remained. So it's an out-of-bounds interrupt. And it immediately terminates the program. But you should say, well, this can only run the application app 2. What about when you run app 1? What about when you run app 3? How will they run? No, I don't want more hardware.
Would you just up every time the CPU sends to memory, it would update the registers?
I don't want that to happen, because then it'll update the register to something else. I want X and S to be in there, untouchable.
Well, I'm just saying every time the CPU switches.
Oh, there's a context switch. Like this operating system decides to run application 1 instead of application 2. Okay, so application 2, which is currently running, is at X. Application 1 is at P, let's say. So if I somehow want to run application 1, I will have to change this to P and an appropriate size, right? How do I change the register in the memory protection unit? Who's I? Oh, well, I'm the operating system. I need to go and change that. What possibly could be the method that would be implemented by Mr. Hardware Designer, which will allow me to do that? An opcode, a special new opcode that changes memory bounds registers, okay? But then we've run into the other trap, which is, Mr. Application 2 guy will use that opcode to change the memory protection register and mess around with your system. So the memory protection implemented this way works, but somebody needs to be able to change those things. And if the CPU is unable to change those things using opcodes, then applications can change it too. So you didn't achieve anything. Got it? So now we have to fix this problem. Turns out you can fix this problem using some CPU stuff, again in hardware. And if you use those CPU stuff, they don't work unless if this is there. So it's kind of a synergy between two completely different things. A doesn't work without B, B doesn't work without A. Put both together, it works. So I'll do that next class.
So we're changing the XMES for that, right? That
yeah.
Size would also change? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Access your web page. I couldn't
access
it through
Blackboard.
I didn't find it.
No, it's not in the Blackboard. Do a Google search on my name. You'll find it.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
So sorry.
I've read it, it's reasonably good.
Okay.
Older editions and
just start
better
with
or something.
Kind of work.
Yeah, no, you'll see the topics.
Yeah.
So I skip a little or focus on something, you'll find it. And you may want to borrow and take a look at it first before you decide or get an old
copy. I downloaded a PDF.
Okay, so well, then you can just read it.
Browse through it.
Yeah, cool. It's easy to read.
Yeah. Thanks.
Sir, I went to the bookstore the other day and asked about the book for this class, and he said it is provided with the course,
okay.
So they don't have it over there.
I haven't even got the blackboard.
Just so you know.
It's a complete mystery.
Yeah,
but,
welcome to ASU.
Do you have any contact where you can complain that why am I not getting the book? No.
I looked it up with the ISBN, with the people over there, and they said they don't have it because of, that's how it was coded.
So
I just
point is,
you know,
were you charged for it? And if you weren't, then you have a gripe. If you weren't, then just go buy a $10 copy.
Yeah, I was just letting you know what their stance
is. I tried, and I couldn't. So yeah, okay. So that's another data point.
So I'm used to the runaround. Thank you.
Okay.
Are there any specific chapters that we have to read? Chapter 1, what's that?
There is, if you look at the contents, you'll match up. There's chapter 1, basics, and then protection is another section in there.
Okay. Yeah, so when there's another app here, like there's two apps, and app 1 begins to address P, so what does this mean?
Applications use memory.
Yeah.
They use memory by addressing memory. Mm-hmm. The addresses they use have to be within the memory space that it's executing in, because there are multiple apps. So it shouldn't use other people's memory.
So you cross out X and then...
Oh, then I put P. That's because if app 1 stops running and app 2 starts running, which is done by the operating system, then the operating system will change X to P so that the other application can use its own space.
Okay. So X to, so X here, it's on.
That's the size. That should also change. I forgot to change it.
Yeah. So S increases. S is the site register.